Sanders and sent his brother Stannis, Lord of Dragonstone, around Dorne with a royal fleet. Warships from Oldtown and the Arbor and the Reach joined their strength to his. Balon Greyjoy sent his own brother, Victarion, to meet them, but in the Straits of Fair Isle, Lord Stannis lured the Ironborn into a trap and smashed the Iron Fleet. With Balon's moat now undefended, King Robert had no difficulty bringing his host across Ironman's Bay from Seaguard and Lannisport. With his wardens of the west and north beside him, Robert forced landings on Pike, Great Wick, Harlaw, and Orkmont, and cut his way across the isles with steel and fire. Balon was forced to fall back to his stronghold at Pike, but when Robert brought down his curtain wall and sent his knights storming through the breach, all resistance collapsed. The reborn kingdom of the Iron Isles had lasted less than a year. Yet when Balon Greyjoy was brought before King Robert in chains, the Iron Man remained defiant. "You may take my head," he told the king, "but you cannot name me traitor. No Greyjoy ever swore an oath to a Baratheon." Robert Baratheon, ever merciful, is said to have laughed at that, for he liked spirit in a man, even in his foes. "Swear one now," he replied, "or lose that stubborn head of yours." And so Balon Greyjoy bent his knee and was allowed to live, after giving up his last surviving son as a hostage to his loyalty. The Iron Islands endure today as they always have. From the reign of the Red Kraken to our present day, the story of the Ironborn is the story of a people caught between dreams of past glory and the poverty of the present, set apart from Westeros proper by the grey-green waters of the sea. The islands remain a realm unto themselves. The sea is always moving, always changing, the Ironborn like to say, and yet it remains eternal, boundless, never the same, and always the same. So it is with the Ironborn themselves, the people of the sea. You may dress an Iron Man in silks and velvets, teach him to read and write, and give him books, instruct him in chivalry and courtesy and the mysteries of the faith, writes Archmaester Hayrig. But when you look into his eyes, the sea will still be there, cold and grey and cruel. Pike. Pike is neither the largest nor the grandest castle on the Iron Islands, but it may well be the oldest, and it is from there that the lords of House Greyjoy rule the Ironborn. It has long been their contention that the Isle of Pike takes its name from the castle. The small folk of the islands insist the opposite is true. Pike is so ancient that no one can say with certainty when it was built, or the name of the lord who built it. Like the sea stone chair, its origins are lost in mystery. Once, centuries ago, Pike was as other castles, built on solid stone on a cliff overlooking the sea, with a wall and keeps and towers. But the cliffs it rested upon were not as solid as they seemed, and beneath the endless pounding of the waves they began to crumble. Walls fell, the ground gave way, outer buildings were lost. What remains of Pike today is a complex of towers and keeps, scattered across half a dozen islets and sea stacks above the booming waves. A section of curtain wall, with a great gatehouse and defensive towers, stretches across the headland, the only access to the castle, and is all that remains of the original fortress. A stone bridge from the headland leads to the first and largest islets and great keep of Pike. Beyond that, rope bridges connect the towers one to the other. The Greyjoys are fond of saying that any man who can walk one of these bridges when a storm is howling can as easily run the oars. Beneath the castle walls, the waves still smash against the remaining rock stacks day and night, and one day those two will doubtless crash into the sea. The Westerlands. The Westerlands are a place of rugged hills and rolling plains, of misty dales and craggy shorelines, a place of blue lakes and sparkling rivers and fertile fields, of broadleaf forests that teem with game of every sort, where half-hidden doors in the sides of wooded hills open unto labyrinthine caves that wend their way through darkness to reveal unimaginable wonders and vast treasures deep beneath the earth. These are rich lands, temperate and fruitful, shielded by high hills to the east and south, and the endless blue waters of the sunset sea to the west. Once the children of the forest made their homes in the woods, whilst giants dwelt amongst the hills, where their bones can still occasionally be found. But then the first men came with fire and bronze axes to cut down the forest, plough the fields, and drive roads through the hill country where the giants made their abodes. Soon the first men's farms and villages spread across the west from salt to stone, protected by stout motte and bailey forts, and later great stone castles, until the giants were no more, and the children of the forest vanished into the deep woods, the hollow hills, and far north. Many and more great houses trace their roots back to this golden age of the first men. Amongst these are the Hawthorns, the Foots, the Brooms, and the Plums. On Fair Isle, the longships of the Farmans helped defend the western coast against iron-born reavers. The Greenfields raised a vast timber castle called the Bower, now simply Greenfield, built entirely of weirwood. The rains of Castamere made a rich system of mines, caves, and tunnels as their subterranean seat, whilst the Westerlings built the crag above the waves. Other houses sprang from the loins of legendary heroes, of whom tales are told to this very day. The Craighors from Craig the Boar Killer, the Bainforts from the Hooded Man, the Ewes from the Blind Bowman, Alan of the Oak, the Moorlands from Pate the Ploughman. Each of these families became powers, and some in time took on the styles of lords and even kings. Yet by far the greatest lords in the Westerlands were the Casterlies of the Rock, who had their seat in a colossal stone that rose beside the sunset sea. Legend tells us that the first Casterly lord was a huntsman, Corlys, son of Castor, who lived in a village near to where Lannisport stands today. When a lion began preying upon the village sheep, Corlys tracked it back to its den, a cave in the base of the rock. Armed only with a spear, he slew the lion and his mate, but spared her newborn cubs, an act of mercy that so pleased the old gods, for this was long before the Seven came to Westeros, that they sent a sudden shaft of sunlight deep into the cave, and there, in the stony walls, Corlys beheld the gleam of yellow gold, a vein as thick as a man's waist. The truth of that tale is lost in the mists of time, but we cannot doubt that Corlys, or some progenitor of what would become House Casterly, found gold inside the rock and soon began to mine there. To defend his treasure against those who would make off with it, he moved inside the cave and fortified its entrance. As years and centuries passed, his descendants delved deeper and deeper into the earth, following the gold, whilst carving halls and galleries and stairways and tunnels into the rock itself, transforming the gigantic stone into a mighty fastness that dwarfed every castle in Westeros. Though never kings, the Castleys became the richest lords in all of Westeros, and the greatest power in the Westerlands, and remained so for hundreds of years. By then, the Dawn Age had given way to the Age of Heroes. That was when the golden-haired rogue called Lan the Clever appeared from out of the east. Some say he was an Andal adventurer from across the Narrow Sea, though this was millennia before the coming of the Andals to Westeros. Regardless of his origins, the tales agree that somehow Lan the Clever winkled the Castleys out of their rock and took it for his own. The precise method by which he accomplished this remains a matter of conjecture. In the most common version of the tale, Lan discovered a secret way inside the rock, a cleft so narrow that he had to strip off his clothes and coat himself with butter in order to squeeze through. Once inside, however, he began to work his mischief, whispering threats in the ears of sleeping Castleys, howling from the darkness like a demon, stealing treasures from one brother to plant in the bedchamber of another, rigging sundry snares and deadfalls. By such methods, he set the Castleys at odds with one another, and convinced them that the rock was haunted by some fell creature that would never let them live in peace. Other tellers prefer other versions of the tale. In one, Lan uses the cleft to fill the rock with mice, rats, and other vermin, thereby driving out the Castleys. In another, he smuggles a pride of lions inside, and Lord Castley and his sons are all devoured, after which Lan claims his lordship's wife and daughters for himself. The bawdiest of the stories has Lan stealing in night after night to have his way with the Castley maidens whilst they slept. In 9 months' time, these maids all give birth to golden-haired children while still insisting they had never had carnal knowledge of a man. The last tale, ribald as it is, has certain intriguing aspects that might hint at the truth of what occurred. It is Archmaester Peristan's belief that Lan was a retainer of some sort in service to Lord Castley, perhaps a household guard, who impregnated his lordship's daughter, or daughters, though that seems less likely, and persuaded her father to give him the girl's hand in marriage. If indeed this was what occurred, assuming, as we must, that Lord Castley had no true-born sons, then in the natural course of events the rock would have passed to the daughter, and hence to Lan, upon the father's death. There is, to be sure, no more historical evidence for this than any of the other versions. All that is known for certain is that sometime during the Age of Heroes, the Castleys vanished from the Chronicles, and the hitherto unknown Lannisters appear in their place, ruling large portions of the Westerlands from beneath Castley Rock. Lan the Clever supposedly lived to the age of 312, and sired 100 bold sons and 100 lissom daughters, all fair of face, clean of limb, and blessed with hair as golden as the sun. But such tales aside, the history suggests that the early Lannisters were fertile, as well as fair, for many names began to appear in the chronicles, and within a few generations, Lan's descendants had grown so numerous that even Castley Rock could not contain all of them. Rather than tunnel out new passages in the stone, some sons and daughters from lesser branches of the house left to make their homes in a village a scant mile away. The land was fertile. The sea teemed with fish, and the site they had chosen had an excellent natural harbour. Soon enough, the village grew into a town, then a city, Lannisport. By the time the Andals came, Lannisport had become the second biggest city in Westeros. Only Old Town was larger and richer, and trading ships from every corner of the world were sailing up the western coasts to call upon the Golden City on the Sunset Sea. Gold had made House Lannister rich. Trade made it even richer. The Lannisters of Lannisport prospered, built great walls around their city to defend it from those, chiefly Ironborn, who sought to steal their wealth, and soon became kings. Lan the Clever never called himself a king, as best we know, though some tales told centuries later have conferred that styling on him posthumously. The first true Lannister king we know of is Lorien Lannister, also known as Lorien the Lion. A number of Lannisters through the centuries have been dubbed the Lion or the Golden for understandable reasons, who made the reigns of Castamere his vassals by wedding a daughter of that house, and defeated the hooded king Morgan Bainfort and his thralls in a war that lasted 20 years. Lorien might have been the first Lannister to style himself King of the Rock, but it was a title his sons and grandsons and their successors continued to bear for thousands of years. However, the boundaries of their kingdom did not reach their full scope until the arrival of the Andal invaders. The Andals came late to the Westerlands, long after they had taken the Vale and toppled the kingdoms of the first men in the Riverlands. The first Andal warlord to march an army through the hills met a bloody end at the hands of King Tybalt Lannister, called, unsurprisingly, the Thunderbolt. The second and third attacks were dealt with likewise. But as more and more Andals began moving west in bands large and small, King Tyrion III and his son Gerald II saw their doom ahead. Rather than attempting to throw back the invaders, these sage kings arranged marriages for the more powerful of the Andal war chiefs with the daughters of the great houses of the West. Cautious men, and well aware of what had happened in the Vale, they took care to demand a price for this largesse. The sons and daughters of the Andal lord so ennobled were taken as wards and fosterlings to serve as squires and pages and cupbearers in Castle Rock, and as hostages should their fathers prove treacherous. In time, Lannister kings wed their children to Andals as well. Indeed, when Gerald III died without male issues, a council crowned his only daughter's husband, Sir Geoffrey Lyddon, who took the Lannister name and became the first Andal to rule the Rock. Other noble houses were also born in such unions, such as Jast, Lefford, Perrin, Grokes, Marbrand, Brax, Serret, Sarsfield, and Kindle. And thus revitalized, the kings of the Rock expanded their realm still farther. Serin Lannister extended his rule as far east as the Golden Tooth and its surrounding hills, defeating three lesser kings when they made an alliance against him. Tommen Lannister, the first of his name, built a great fleet and brought Fair Isle into the realm, taking the daughter of the last Farman king to wife. Lorien II held the first tourney ever seen in the Westlands, defeating every knight who rode against him. The first Lancel Lannister, known, of course, as Lancel the Lion, rode to war against the Gardener kings of Highgarden and conquered the reach as far south as Old Oak before being felled in battle. His son Lorien III lost all his father had gained and earned the mocking name of Lorien the Limp. King Gerald Lannister, known as Gerald the Great, sailed to the Iron Islands and returned with 100 Ironborn hostages, promising to hang one every time the Iron Men dared raid his shores. True to his word, Gerald hanged more than 20 of the hostages. Lancel the Fourth is said to have beheaded the Ironborn king, Harold Halfdrond, and his heir with a single stroke of the Valyrian steel greatsword, Brightraw, at the Battle of Land's Point. He later died in battle at Red Lake whilst attempting to invade the Reach. Some of the Lannister kings were famed for their wisdom, some for their valour, all for their open-handedness. Save perhaps for King Norwyn Lannister, better known as Norwyn the Niggardly. Yet Castle Rock also housed many a weak, cruel, and feeble king. Lorien the Fourth was better known as Lorien the Lackwit, and his grandson, Lorien the Fifth, was dubbed Queen Loria, for he was fond of dressing in his wife's clothing and wandering the docks of Lannisport in the guise of a common prostitute. After their reigns, the name Lorien became notably less common amongst Lannister princes. A later monarch, Tyrion the Second, was known as the Tormentor. Though a strong king famed for prowess with his battle axe, his true delight was torture, and it was whispered of him that he desired no woman unless he first made her bleed. Ultimately, the Lannister domains extended from the western shore to the headwaters of the Red Fork and Tumblestone, marked by the pass beneath the Golden Tooth, and from the southern shore of Ironman's Bay to the borders of the Reach. The boundaries of the Westerlands today follow those of the Kingdom of the Rock, as it was before the Field of Fire, when King Loren Lannister, Loren the Last, knelt as a king and rose as a lord. But in bygone days the boundaries were more fluid, particularly to the south, where the Lannisters oft contended against the Gardeners in the Reach, and to the east, where they warred against the many kings of the Trident. In addition, the Lannister coastline lay closer to the Iron Islands than did any other kingdom, and the wealth of Lannisport and its trade was a constant temptation to the reavers of those benighted isles. Wars between the Westermen and the Ironborn erupted every generation or so. Even during periods of peace, the Ironmen came raiding after wealth and salt wives. Fair Isle did help shield the coast farther south. For this reason, the Farmans have become famous for their hatred of the Ironborn. The great wealth of the Westerlands, of course, stems primarily from their gold and silver mines. The veins of ore run wide and deep, and there are mines, even now, that have been delved for 1,000 years and more, and are yet to be emptied. Lomas Longstrider reports that, even in far Ashai by the Shadow, there were merchants who asked him if it was true that the Lion Lord lived in a palace of solid gold, and that crofters collected a wealth of gold simply by ploughing their fields. The gold of the West has travelled far, and the maesters know there are no mines in all the world as rich as those of Casterly Rock.
The sword Brightraw came into the possession of the Lannister kings in the century before the Doom, and it is said that the weight of gold they paid for it would have been enough to raise an army. But it was lost little more than a century later, when Tommen the Second carried it with him when he sailed with his great fleet to ruin Valyria with the intention of plundering the wealth and sorcery he was sure still remained. The fleet never returned, nor Tommen, nor Brightraw. The last report of them is found in a Volantine chronicle called The Glory of Volantis. There it stated that a golden fleet bearing the Lion King had stayed there for supplies, and that the Triarchs lavished him with gifts. The chronicle claims that he swore that half of all he found would be given to the Triarchs in return for their generosity, and a promise to send their fleet to his aid when he requested it. After that, he sailed away. The year after, the chronicle claims that the Triarch, Marcello Tagaras, dispatched a squadron of ships toward Valyria to see if any sign of the Golden Fleet could be found, but they returned empty-handed. The wealth of the Westerlands was matched, in ancient times, with the hunger of the freeholder Valyria for precious metals, yet there seems no evidence that the Dragon Lords ever made contact with the Lords of the Rock, Casterly or Lannister. Septon Barth speculated on the matter, referring to a Valyrian text that has since been lost, suggesting that the Freehold sorcerers foretold that the gold of Casterly Rock would destroy them. Archmaester Peristan has put forward a different, more plausible speculation, suggesting that the Valyrians had, in ancient days, reached as far as Old Town, but suffered some great reverse or tragedy there that caused them to shun all of Westeros thereafter.
House Lannister under the Dragons. Once Loren the Last gave up his crown, the Lannisters were reduced to lords. Though their vast wealth remained untouched, they did not have close ties to House Targaryen. Unlike the Baratheons, and unlike the Tullys, they were too proud to at once scrabble for a place of prominence beneath the Iron Throne. It was not until a generation later, when Prince Aegon and Princess Rhaena sought refuge from King Maegor the Cruel, that the Lannisters once again began to make a greater mark on the realm. Lord Lyman Lannister protected the prince and princess under his roof, extending guest right and refusing all the king's demands to turn them over. Yet his lordship did not pledge his swords to the fugitive prince and princess, nor did he bestir himself until after Prince Aegon had perished at his uncle's hands during the battle beneath the God's Eye. Yet when Aegon's youngest brother, Jaehaerys, put forward his own claim to the Iron Throne, the Lannisters rallied to his support. King Maegor's death and King Jaehaerys' coronation moved House Lannister closer to the Iron Throne, though the Valyrians, the Aerons, the Hightowers, the Tullys, and the Baratheons still eclipsed them in influence. Lord Tywin Lannister was present at the Great Council of 101 AC that decided the succession, famously arriving with a huge retinue of 300 bannermen, men-at-arms and servants, only to be outdone by Lord Mathys Tyrell of Highgarden, who counted 500 in his retinue. The Lannisters chose to side with Prince Viserys in the deliberations, a choice remembered and rewarded some years later, when Viserys ascended the Iron Throne and made Lord Jason Lannister's twin brother, Sir Tyland, his master of ships. Later, Sir Tyland became master of coin for King Aegon II, and his close association with the Iron Throne and favoured position at court brought his brother, Lord Jason, into the Dance of the Dragons on Aegon's side. As the struggle for succession continued, however, Sir Tyland suffered greatly for hiding the greater part of the crown's gold where Rhaenyra Targaryen could not reach it when she took King's Landing. And the Lannisters' association with the Iron Throne proved ill-fated when the Red Kraken and his Reavers fell upon the undefended Westerlands while Lord Jason marched east at King Aegon II's behest. Queen Rhaenyra's supporters met his host at the crossing of the Red Fork, where Lord Jason fell in battle, mortally wounded by the grizzled squire, Pate of Longleaf. Knighted after the battle, this low-born warrior was known as the Lion Slayer for the rest of his days. The Lannister host continued to march, winning victories under Sir Adrian Tarbeck, then under Lord Lyford, before he perished at the Fish Feed, where his Westermen were slaughtered among three armies. Sir Tyland Lannister, meanwhile, fell prisoner to Queen Rhaenyra after she seized King's Landing, cruelly tortured to force him to reveal where he had hidden the bulk of the crown's gold. Sir Tyland steadfastly refused to talk. When Aegon II and his loyalists won back the city, he was found to have been blinded, mutilated, and gilded. Yet his wits remained intact, and King Aegon retained him as master of Coin. In the last days of his rule, Aegon II even sent Sir Tylan to the Free Cities in search of sellswords to support his cause against Rhaenyra's son, the future Aegon III, and his supporters. A regency followed the end of the fighting, since the new king, Aegon III, was but 11 years of age when he ascended the Iron Throne. In hopes of binding up the deep wounds left by the dance, Sir Tylan Lannister was made Hand of the King. Perhaps those who had been his enemies deemed him too blind and broken to be a threat to them. But Sir Tylan served ably for the better part of 2 years, before dying of the winter fever in 133 AC. In the years that followed, the Lannisters stood with the Targaryens against Daemon Blackfyre. Though the Black Dragon's rebels won victories of note in the Westerlands, especially at Lannisport and the Golden Tooth, where Sir Quentin Ball, the hot-tempered knight, renowned as Fireball, slew Lord Lefford and sent Lord Daemon Lannister, later famed as the Grey Lion, into retreat. Following the Grey Lion's passing in 210 AC, his son Tybalt succeeded him as Lord of Casterly Rock, only to perish himself 2 years later under suspicious circumstances. A young man in his prime, Lord Tybalt left no heir of the body, save for a daughter, Sorrel, 3 years of age, whose reign as Lady of Casterly Rock proved cruelly short. In less than a year, she too was dead, whereupon the Rock and the Westerlands and all the wealth and power of House Lannister passed to her uncle, Gerald, the late Lord Tybalt's younger brother. A genial man known to be exceedingly clever, Gerald had served as regent for his young niece, but the suddenness of her death at such a tender age set tongues to wagging, and it was whispered widely in the West that both Lady Sorrel and Tybalt had died at his hands. No man now living can say with certainty whether there was any truth to these whispers, for Gerald Lannister soon proved himself to be an exceptionally shrewd, able, and fair-minded lord, greatly increasing the wealth of House Lannister, the power of Casterly Rock, and the trade at Lannisport. He ruled the Westerlands for 31 years, earning the sobriquet Gerald the Golden. Yet the tragedies that befell House Lannister in the years that followed were proof enough for Lord Gerald's enemies. His beloved second wife, Lady Rowan, vanished under mysterious circumstances in 230 AC, less than a year after giving birth to his lordship's fourth and youngest son, Jason. Tywald, the eldest of his twin sons, died in battle in 233 AC while squaring for Lord Robert Rayn of Castamere during the Peak Uprising. Lord Robert likewise died, leaving Sir Roger Rayn, the Red Lion, his elder son, as his heir. The most significant death by far that stemmed from the Peak Uprising was that of King Maekhar himself. But the chaos this caused has been abundantly chronicled elsewhere. Less well known, but no less baleful, are the dire effects the battle had upon the history of the West. Tywin Lannister had long been betrothed to the Red Lion's spirited young sister, Lady Ellen. This strong-willed and hot-tempered maiden, who had for years anticipated becoming the Lady of Casterly Rock, was unwilling to forsake that dream. In the aftermath of her betrothed's death, she persuaded his twin brother, Theon, to set aside his own betrothal to a daughter of Lord Rowan of Golden Grove and espouse her instead. Lord Gerald, it is said, opposed this match, but grief and age and illness had left him a pale shadow of his former self, and in the end he gave way. In 235 AC, in a double wedding at Casterly Rock, Sir Tyrion Lannister took Ellen Rayne to wife, whilst his younger brother, Titus, wed Jane Marbrand, a daughter of Lord Alan Marbrand of Ashmark. Twice a widower and ailing, Lord Gerald did not wed again, so after her marriage, Ellen of House Rain became the Lady of Castle Rock in all but name. As her good father retreated to his books and his bedchamber, Lady Ellen held a splendid court, staging a series of magnificent tourneys and balls, and filling the rock with artists, mummers, musicians, and reigns. Her brothers, Roger and Reynard, were ever at her side, and officers, honours, and lands were showered upon them, and upon her uncles, cousins and nephews, and nieces as well. Lord Gerald's aged fool, an acerbic hunchback called Lord Toad, was heard to say, "Lady Ellen must surely be a sorceress, for she has made it rain inside the rock all year." In 236 AC, the pretender Damon Blackfire, third of his name, crossed the narrow sea and landed upon Massey's Hook with Bitter Steel and the Golden Company, intent on taking the Iron Throne. King Aegon V summoned leal lords from all across the Seven Kingdoms to oppose him, and the Fourth Blackfyre Rebellion began. It ended far more quickly than the pretender might have wished, at the Battle of Wendwater Bridge. Afterward, the corpses of the Black Dragon slain choked the Wendwater and sent it overflowing its banks. The royalists, in turn, lost fewer than 100 men, but amongst them was Sir Tyrion Lannister, heir to Castle Rock. The loss of the second of his glorious twins might well have been expected to break their grieving father, Lord Gerald. But curiously, the opposite seemed to be the case. As Sir Tyrion's body was laid to rest within Castle Rock, Gerald the Golden roused himself and took firm hold of the Westerlands once more, intent on doing all he could to prepare his third-born son, the weak-willed and unpromising boy, Titus, to succeed him. The reign of the Rains was at an end. Lady Ellen's brother soon departed Castle Rock for Castamere, accompanied by many of the other Rains. Lady Ellen remained, but her influence dwindled, while that of Lady Jane grew. Soon the rivalry between Sir Tyrion's widow and Titus's wife became truly ugly, if the rumour set down by Maester Belden can be believed. Belden tells us that in 239 AC, Ellen Rain was accused of bedding Titus Lannister, urging him to set aside his wife and marry her instead. However, young Titus, then 19, found his brother's widow so intimidating that he was unable to perform. Humiliated, he ran back to his wife to confess and beg her forgiveness. Lady Jane was willing to pardon her young husband, but was less forgiving of her good sister, and did not hesitate to inform Lord Gerald of the incident. Furious, his lordship resolved to rid Castle Rock of Ellen Rain for good and all by finding her a new husband. Ravens flew, and a hasty match was made. Within the fortnight, Ellen Rain was wed to Waldron Tarbuck, Lord of Tarbuck Hall, the florid 55-year-old widowed lord of an ancient, honourable, but impoverished house. Ellen Rain, now Lady Tarbuck, departed Castle Rock with her husband, never to return. But the rivalry between her and Lady Jane was not at an end. If anything, it seemed to intensify through what Lord Toad came to call the War of the Wombs. Though Lady Ellen had not been able to give Sir Tyrion an heir, she proved more fertile with Waldron Tarbuck, who, it should be noted, had a number of older sons from his first two marriages, giving him two daughters and a son. Lady Jane answered with children of her own, the first of whom was a son. He was given the name Tywin. and legend claims that when his grandsire, Lord Gerald, ruffled the babe's golden hair, the child bit his finger. Other children followed in good course, but Tywin the eldest was the only grandchild his lordship ever knew. In 244 AC, Gerald the Golden died of a bad bladder, unable to pass water. At the age of 24, Tytus Lannister, his eldest surviving son, became Lord of Casterly Rock, Shield of Lannisport, and Warden of the West. All were offices for which he was manifestly unsuited. Lord Tytus Lannister had many virtues. Slow to anger and quick to forgive, he saw good in every man, great or small, and was too trusting by heart. He was dubbed the Laughing Lion for his jovial manner, and for a time the West laughed with him, but soon enough more were laughing at him instead. Where matters of state were concerned, Lord Tytus proved weak-willed and indecisive. He had no taste for war, and laughed away insults that would have had most of his forebears shouting for their swords. Many saw in his weakness an opportunity to grasp power, wealth, and land for themselves. Some borrowed heavily from Castle Rock, then failed to repay the loans. When it was seen that Lord Tytus was willing to extend such debts, even forgive them, common merchants from Lannisport and Case began to beg for loans as well. Lord Tytus's edicts were widely ignored, and corruption became widespread. At feasts and balls, guests felt free to make mock of his lordship, even to his face. Twisting the lion's tail, this was called, and young knights and even squires vied with one another to see who could twist the lion's tail the hardest. It is said that no one laughed louder at these japes than Lord Tytus himself. Maester Belden, in one of his letters to the Citadel, wrote, "His lordship wants only to be loved, so he laughs and takes no offence and forgives and bestows honours and offices and lavish gifts on those who mock him and defy him, seeking thereby to win their loyalty. Yet the more he laughs and gives, the more they despise him." As the power of House Lannister waned, other houses grew stronger, more defiant, and more disorderly. And by 254 AC, even lords beyond the borders of the Westerlands had grown aware that the Lion of Castle Rock was no longer a beast to be feared. Late that year, Lord Tytus agreed to wed his 7-year-old daughter, Jenna, to a younger son of Walder Frey, Lord of the Crossing. Though but 10 years of age, Tywin denounced the betrothal in scathing terms. Lord Tytus did not relent, yet still men could see that this iron-willed, fearless child was hard beyond his years, and nothing like his amiable father. Not long after, Lord Tytus dispatched his heir to King's Landing to serve as a cupbearer at King Aegon's court. His lordship's second son, Kevin, was sent away as well, to serve as page and later squire to the Lord of Costermere. Old, rich, and powerful, the Raines had prospered greatly from Lord Tytus's misrule. Roger Raine, the Red Lion, was widely feared for his skill at arms. Many considered him the deadliest sword in the Westerlands. His brother, Sir Reynard, was as charming and cunning as Sir Roger was swift and strong. As the Raines rose, so too did their close allies, the Tarbucks of Tarbuck Hall. After centuries of slow decline, this poor but ancient house had begun to flourish, thanks in large part to the new Lady Tarbuck, the former Ellen Raine. Though she herself remained unwelcome at the Rock, Lady Ellen had contrived to extract large sums of gold from House Lannister through her brothers, for Lord Tytus found it very hard to refuse the Red Lion. Those funds she had used to restore the crumbling ruin that was Tarbuck Hall, rebuilding its curtain wall, strengthening its towers, and furnishing its keep in splendour to rival any castle in the West. In 255 AC, Lord Titus celebrated the birth of his fourth son at Castle Rock, but his joy soon turned to sorrow. His beloved wife, the Lady Jane, never recovered from her labour, and died within a moon's turn of Geryon Lannister's birth. Her loss was a shattering blow to his lordship. From that day forth, no one ever again called him the Laughing Lion. The years that followed were as dismal as any in the long history of the Westerlands. Conditions in the West grew so bad that the Iron Throne felt compelled to take a hand. Thrice King Aegon V sent forth his knights to restore order to the Westerlands, but each time the conflicts flared up once again as soon as the king's men had taken their leave. When His Grace perished in the tragedy at Summerhall in 259 AC, matters in the West deteriorated even further, for the new king, Jaehaerys II Targaryen, lacked his sire's strength of will, and was besides soon embroiled in the War of the Ninepenny Kings. 1,000 knights and 10,000 men-at-arms went forth from the Westerlands at the king's call, but Lord Titus was not among them. His lordship's brother was given command in his stead, but in 260 AC, Sir Jason Lannister died on Bloodstone. After his death, Sir Roger Raine seized command of the remaining Westermen and led them to several notable victories. Lord Titus's three elder sons also acquitted themselves well upon the Stepstones. Knighted on the eve of the conflict, Sir Tywin Lannister fought in the retinue of the king's young heir, Aerys, Prince of Dragonstone, and was given the honour of dubbing him a knight at War's End. Kevin Lannister, squiring for the Red Lion, also won his spurs, and was knighted by Roger Raine himself. Their brother Tygert was too young for knighthood, but his courage and skill at arms were remarked upon by all, for he slew a grown man in his first battle, and three more in later fights, one of them a knight of the Golden Company. Yet whilst his cubs were fighting on the Stepstones, Titus Lannister remained at Castle Rock, in the company of a certain young woman of low birth who had caught his eye while serving as a wet nurse to his youngest son. The return of Lord Titus's sons from war finally heralded change. Hardened by battle, and all too aware of the low regard in which the other lords of the realm held his father, Sir Tywin Lannister set out at once to restore the pride and power of Castle Rock. His sire protested but feebly, we are told, then retreated back to the arms of his wet nurse, whilst his heir took command. Sir Tywin began by demanding repayment of all the gold Lord Titus had lent out. Those who could not pay were required to send hostages to Castle Rock. 500 knights, blooded and seasoned veterans of the Stepstones, were formed into a new company under the command of Sir Tywin's brother, Sir Kevin, and charged with ridding the West of robber knights and outlaws. Some hastened to obey. The lion has awoken, said Sir Harry Swift, the knight of Cornfield, when the collectors arrived at his castle gates. Unable to repay his debt, he turned his daughter over to Sir Kevin as a hostage instead. But elsewhere the collectors were met with sullen resistance and open defiance. Lord Raine reportedly laughed when his maester read him Sir Tywin's edicts and counselled his friends and vassals to do nothing. Lord Waldron Tarbuck, unwisely, chose a different course. He rode to Castle Rock to protest. Confidence in his ability to cow Lord Titus and force him to rescind his son's edicts. but he found himself facing Sir Tywin instead, who had him consigned to a dungeon. With Lord Waldron in chains, Tywin Lannister no doubt expected the Tarbucks to yield, but Lady Tarbuck was quick to disabuse him of that notion. Instead, that redoubtable woman sent forth her own knights and captured three Lannisters. Two of the captives were Lannisters of Lannisport, distant kin to the Lannisters of Castle Rock, but the third was a young squire, Stafford Lannister, the elder son and heir of Lord Tyth's late brother, Sir Jason. The resulting crisis drew Lord Titus away from his wet nurse long enough to overrule his strong-willed heir. His lordship not only commanded that Lord Tarbuck be released, unharmed, but also went so far as to apologize to him and forgive him his debts. To safeguard the exchange of hostages, Lord Titus turned to Lady Tarbuck's younger brother, Sir Reynard Rane. The Red Lion's formidable seat at Castamere was chosen to host the meet. Sir Tywin refused to attend, so it was Sir Kevin who returned Lord Waldron, whilst Lady Tarbuck herself delivered Stafford and his cousins. Lord Rane feasted all the parties, and a great show of amity was staged, with Lannisters and Tarbucks toasting one another, exchanging gifts and kisses, and vowing to remain each other's leal friends through all eternity. All eternity lasted not quite a year, Grand Maester Pycelle observed later. Tywin Lannister, who had not been present at the Red Lion's feast, had never weakened in his resolve to bring these overmighty vassals to heel. Late in the year 261 AC, he sent ravens to Castamere and Tarbeck Hall, demanding that Roger and Reynard Rane and Lord and Lady Tarbeck present themselves at Castle Rock to answer for your crimes. The Raines and Tarbucks chose defiance instead, as Sir Tywin surely knew they would. Both houses rose in open revolt, renouncing their fealty to Castle Rock. So Tywin Lannister called the banners. He did not seek his lord father's leave, nor even inform him of his intent, but rode forth himself, with 500 knights and 3,000 men-at-arms and crossbowmen behind him. House Tarbeck was the first to feel Sir Tywin's wrath. The Lannister host descended so quickly that Lord Waldron's vassals and supporters had no time to gather. Foolishly, his lordship rode forth to meet Sir Tywin's host, with only his household knights beside him. In a short, brutal battle, the Tarbucks were broken and butchered. Lord Waldron Tarbuck and his sons were beheaded, together with his nephews and cousins, his daughters' husbands, and any man who displayed the seven-pointed blue and silver star upon his shield, or surcoat, to boast of Tarbuck blood. And when the Lannister host resumed its march to Tarbeck Hall, the heads of Lord Waldron and his sons went before them, impaled on spears. At their approach, Lady Ellen Tarbuck closed her gates and sent forth ravens to Castamere, summoning her brothers. Trusting in her walls, Lady Tarbuck no doubt anticipated a long siege, but siege engines were readied within a day, and those walls proved little help when one great stone flew over them and brought down the castle's aged keep. Lady Ellen and her son Tion the Red died in the keep's sudden collapse. All resistance at Tarbuck Hall ended soon after, and the gates were thrown open to the Lannister host. Tywin Lannister then ordered Tarbeck Hall put to the torch. The castle burned for a day and a night, until naught remained but a blackened shell. The Red Lion arrived in time to see the flames. 2,000 men rode with him, all he had been able to gather in the short time available. Tywin Lannister had 3 times his strength, most accounts agree. Some insist the Lannisters outnumbered the Rains 5-1. Hoping that surprise might carry the day, Roger Rayne commanded his trumpets to sound the attack and charged headlong towards Sir Tywin's camp. After the first shock, the Lannisters recovered quickly, and their numbers soon began to tell. Lord Rayne had no choice but to wheel and flee, leaving near half his men dead upon the field. A rain of crossbow bolts chased his riders from the camp. One took Lord Rayne between the shoulders, punching through his backplate. The Red Lion rode on, only to fall from his horse less than half a league farther on. He had to be carried back to Castamere. The Lannister host arrived at Castamere 3 days later. Like Castle Rock, the seat of House Rayne had begun as a mine. Rich veins of gold and silver had made the Rains as near as wealthy as the Lannisters during the Age of Heroes. To defend their riches, they had raised curtain walls about the entrance to the mine, closed it with an oak and iron gate, and flanked it with a pair of stout towers. Keeps and halls had followed, but all the while the mine shafts had gone deeper and deeper, and when at last the gold gave out, they had been widened into halls and galleries and snug bedchambers, a warren of tunnels and a vast echoing ballroom. To the ignorant eye, Castamere seemed a modest holding, a fit seat for a landed knight or small lord, but those who knew its secrets knew that 9/10 of the castle was beneath the ground. It was to those deep chambers that the Rains retreated now. Feverish and weak from loss of blood, the Red Lion was in no fit state to lead. Sir Reynard, his brother, assumed command in his stead. Less headstrong but more cunning than his brother, Reynard knew that he did not have the men to defend the castle walls, so he abandoned the service entirely to the foe and fell back beneath the earth. Once all his folk were safe inside the tunnels, Sir Reynard sent word to Sir Tywin above, offering terms. But Tywin Lannister did not honour Sir Reynard's offer with a reply. Instead, he commanded that the mines be sealed. With pick and axe and torch, his own miners brought down tons of stone and soil, burying the great gates to the mines until there was no way in and no way out. Once that was done, he turned his attention to the small, swift stream that fed the crystalline blue pool beside the castle from which Castamere took its name. It took less than a day to dam the stream, and only 2 to divert it to the nearest mine entrance. The earth and stone that sealed the mine had no gaps large enough to allow a squirrel to pass, let alone a man. But the water found its way down. Sir Reynard had taken more than 300 men, women, and children into the mine, it is said. Not a one emerged. A few of the guards assigned to the smallest and most distant of the mine entrances reported hearing faint screams and shouts coming from beneath the earth one night. But by daybreak, the stones had gone silent once again. No one has ever reopened the mines of Castamere. The halls and keeps above them, put to the torch by Tywin Lannister, stand empty to this day, a mute testament to the fate that awaits those foolish enough to take up arms against the Lions of the Rock. In 262 AC, King Jaehaerys II died in King's Landing, having sat the Iron Throne for only 3 years. His son Aerys, Prince of Dragonstone, succeeded him as King Aerys II. His first act as king, and his wisest, many say, was to summon his boyhood friend, Tywin Lannister from Casterly Rock and name him the Hand of the King. Sir Tywin was but 20, the youngest man ever to serve as Hand, but the manner in which